Poland looks to Moscow for a scheme. So the junta turns to Washington to crush your people's dreams, while the white hand of the death squads and the rumble of the tanks keeps the coffee on our tables and the money in our banks. No months, no more shall the hills of Solidor echo the mountains of Virginia. We cry shall turn to plowshares till the land is theirs to plow, till the name is on the ballot that rots in the prison now, and the weapons of their victory shall be school and food and jobs, and the song from every mountaintop is positive and proud. No months, no more shall the hills of Solidor hold the mountains of
the 1st of September, first day of the fast, stop the deadly weapons, Central America, we valiant people, standing on the tracks, bringing home the message of truth, hope, and love. His body, he was taken away, lost both of his legs to that Navy train. Like the children of Nicaragua and the children of El Salvador, who have given him so much life, so that he can survive. In the midst of the torture, in the midst of the pain, we tried to come together to support Brian as he lay. David was arrested, Duncan laid injured on the ground, trying to sing along with our tear-filled song. And we sang that day we shall overcome. We shall overcome. And hear you now. Brian and Duncan and Dave, come help us stop the lights, oh, and stop the death train. Come on and stop the death train. Stop, stop, stop the death train. Stop, stop, stop the death train. Wound lost legs and life, blood stained on the tracks that day, and Centro America. But the blood of martyrs is the seed of liberty, and I really do believe of that seed we are the fruit. Duncan sang with us, and as Holly held Brian, that day we came to realize, oh yes, that we had just begun. And we sang
My name is David Hartzell. Together with Mark Copeland and Sherry Moran and Ken Buttigan, we'll be emceeing this remembrance today. We want to welcome everybody here. People have come from as far away from Vermont and Oregon and Chicago and all parts of California. Where else?
Florida.
Florida.
Virginia.
Wow.
Virginia.
Vermont.
25 years ago today, we came together as a part of Nuremberg Actions to stop the death trains and the death trucks that were coming along these tracks and, and these roads. We estimate that millions of human beings were killed as a result of bombs that came along these trains, these tracks and these roads. And we felt that we had a responsibility to God, but also to the international law, the Nuremberg principles, that we could not stand idly by while death was going from our neighborhood to people's homes and communities in Central America. And on June 10th of 1987, we actually started Nuremberg Actions. Four of us were arrested blocking a truck just out here to the left and spent that first weekend in jail. When we first started Nuremberg Actions, we didn't know if we could continue for even a week. And we struggled through that whole summer. Sometimes it's 120 degrees out here. And on September 1st, Brian Wilson, Duncan Murphy, David Duncan, I think Bob LaSalle and others started a 40-day fast right here on the tracks and announced to the Navy that they'd be fasting and they'd be blocking the trains and trucks. And the Navy had the choice of stopping those shipment of death trains and trucks or arresting us or running over us. We never imagined that they might actually run over us. Just a couple logistics. Food Not Bombs is here with water and food.
As they were 25 years ago.
And second, if any people would like to come and sit down on the pavement, we're going to be going for a couple hours. So I don't want people to get sunstroke, or if you need to, come over in the shade. You can also hear over here. There's a porta potty over there. At 11:57 today, that's in about 15 minutes or so, that is actually the moment that the train hit Brian. And so whatever else is happening in our program, we're going to stop and have a moment of silence to remember that moment. And that moment was very critical. Even by September, we didn't know whether we could continue another a few more weeks. But instead of stopping Nuremberg Actions by running the train over us, 10,000 people came out the next weekend, many of you, I'm sure. And Nuremberg Actions, and we continued blocking trains and trucks, every train and truck, for 28 months. That was the precursor to the occupation, to Occupy movement that's been happening the last several years, last year. So our program today, obviously the work is not all done. We made a very important beginning 25 years ago. But the first part of our program, it's that people who are actually here on the 1st of September when Brian was run over, including Brian Wilson and Holly Rowan, will share a little bit about their reflections of what that meant. And then we'll have time for any of the rest of us that were there to say a few words about what the significance of that was for us. How many people were here September 21st, 1987? Great.
September.
How many people were here September 5th? With 10,000 others. And how many people were out here between June 10th and, 8 years later, blocking trains and trucks. That's beautiful. You, all of us together, have played an important role in saying no to this export of death and destruction and war all over the world. And I think, we'll talk later, but there's a... So the first part, people who are here September 1st will reflect on that. The second part is people who lived on the tracks and or who came out during those months and years to be a part of Nuremberg Actions.
Well, I have to admit that when we drove up here today, I had, and I saw the base, and I saw some uniformed personnel, I had a little going up inside my chest and stomach. But it's a thrill, actually, to be here because you're all here. And it's like a celebration of a sacred spot and a sacred moment and a sacred campaign. I'm very grateful for the five people that huddled over my body, David Hartzow, Jerry Condon, Polly Rowan, Duncan Murphy, this name slips my mind, from Santa Cruz, Steve Brooks. Those five people huddled over me after the Navy ambulance came and left and wouldn't help, delaying my going to a hospital by 17 minutes. And it was those five people that kept my blood and my spirit alive with my brain wide open from a fractured skull and all my legs gone. And so it was pretty amazing that I'm alive. And I'm thankful for that. And thankful for those people that were with me. There were 40 people there that day, in addition to the five that were hovering over my body, and I was thankful for them. I was thankful for waking up in the hospital. I woke up on September 5th, Saturday, September 5th, and was told there were 8 or 9 or 10,000 people at the tracks, and that was thrilling to know that that was happening. So there's a lot to be grateful for. I've also spent a lot of time in the last 25 years reflecting on lots of different notions and themes that I've been studying and patterns of history, and realizing for myself, at any rate, that being an allegiance to the nation state, or being an obedient citizen of a nation state, is distracting me from being a recovering human being. And so I have discovered that for me, I'm living in an irredeemable culture, but I want to redeem myself and other human beings in new configurations of how we organize ourselves socially and politically all over the world. And that's been a deep reflection and shift in me over the years. That's just a very quick summary of some changes that I've gone through in terms of how to be a human being on the planet that seems to be in sheer madness wherever I look. Waking up every day knowing I live in a country that's bombing multiple peoples in multiple countries. I mean, that's incredible. And for me, I witnessed the bombings in Vietnam. That's just what changed me so deeply. And seeing the aftermath of the villages. And so I still hear the moaning of the people that weren't immediately killed in the villages. I can still hear the moaning. These are the people that are in deep pain. Nobody's coming to their attention or to their concern. And so when I know we're bombing, I kind of viscerally experience this incredible diabolical imposition of suffering on other people. So that's why I've been thrilled about Occupy. I've been thrilled about the notions of an uprising in this country uprising that says no more, we can't, we're not going to cooperate anymore. We're going to be in non-cooperation as we build a new society from below. Not from above, but from below. So this to me is exciting, just being here with people just at this level, because I call myself a Neolithic conservative because I've been studying Neolithic villages and the model of small food-sufficient communities, and I'm conservative because I believe in preserving values and nature and real meaningful relationships. So it's been quite an interesting journey for me to navigate through this culture since I was given the gift of a new life. And so I don't really have any reason not to continue pursuing what I think of as the truth, even if it leads me to places that seem kind of difficult to express to other people, because it's like, I think we're at an evolutionary juncture in human history where we have to examine our epistemology, which would be going from being separate from nature to being, we are nature. And if we are nature, we just can't do what we're doing. If we really experience that inside, I consider that a spiritual and an epistemological shift. And I think Concord Naval Weapons Station Nuremberg actions has had a big part in facilitating that shift in myself. And so I'm just thankful for you all being here. I have no prepared remarks, which is normal for me. I don't ever have anything prepared. And I think time for Holly to come up here and she stopped the bleeding. She was overseeing as a midwife. She was overseeing the first immediate first aid when I'm lying on the tracks. So she was working feverishly to stop my bleeding in those precious moments. For 17 minutes before the other ambulance arrived, the one that did take me to the hospital.
I too am a very unprepared speaker, and it's very, very emotional coming here, driving here. We took a wrong turn. Everything looks so different. And then I look into some of your eyes that were here that day, or that helped a real occupation happen that went from weeks to months to years. It's really profound. And it's really profound also to have my son Gabriel here. Because not only, you know, when you're a family, when one person in the family is hurt, the whole family has repercussions that are a lifetime. And so it was traumatic for us, it was traumatic for my son to watch his brand new stepfather get run over 10 days after we made vows to each other. And the vows we made to each other, though, I would like to say, first I want to say about that, this is the 2012. My son Gabriel and I, we visited, we had a great visit at Dolores Park a couple of days ago, and we lay back and we looked at the sky and the clouds, and we talked about how we both felt every year at this anniversary time, how painful it was, and some of the spirals of depression that both of us have experienced over those 25 years. So we made a pact with each other, and I was going to keep it private, but this is what is coming out of my heart, that we would have a completion here, that we would have a healing here of our hearts, for our children to see violence done to their own family. And I just got back from Guatemala, I want to say, and so I'm really way politicized again after being there and not being able to go to one of the northern provinces, way to Tenango, where it's the Mayan people are still being killed. So I got off track. Anyway, tracks. Here we are. So I see this as a completion and a place of healing and a stopping point for us all. I really do think there's something about this 2012 thing. Not just the Mayans. It's not the end of the world. I feel like this is a time for a beginner. For the beginning, for a new beginning. So that Frankie, where are you? For saying, you know, we have just begun. And that's what I really want to say is we have just begun. And some of us, like myself, I'm turning 60 in 2 months. And in my little community where I live now in Southwest Florida, I'm an elder, a respected elder, even though we don't see a lot of gray hair. And the youth really needs elders. They need us. And so I've said, I'm tired of marching and I'm tired of protesting, and what else can we do? And we had this conversation around the table all day yesterday, pretty much. And I think it starts with growing our own food and becoming small communities, you know, and getting back to the land in whatever way we can, getting back with nature. So for me, I've been, I thought I was getting as far away from possible from California by going to Florida, to the hotbed of human trafficking, to the home of the Coalition of the Immokalee Workers, who I work with. What I found is working as a midwife and a nurse, and there in Florida, was that the mothers and the babies I were visiting, some of them were, most of them, that were Guatemalan, y hablo español, porque por eso yo fui, para cuidar ellos, that's why I went to take care of them. I uncovered 5 different cases of human trafficking within a year and a half, of women being trafficked for sex, sold as little children, 13 and 14 year old girls, and ending up in southern Florida and on a farm circuit of workers, sex workers and farm workers, field workers. So I really want to thank all of you. I really want to say I do still have hope. I know, I think the empire is gonna crumble down and it's crumbling down around us. And so we do need to be, and we are the change that we want to see in this world, and to not give up. Because every time I thought I was walking away from the peace movement, or from the human rights movement, or from women's rights movement, I end up being a Code Pink coordinator in Fort Myers, Florida. So, you know, and a peacemaker for our Occupy movement there. And we do have Occupy in Little Fort Myers. So we are everywhere. Thank you all for being here. I love you with all my heart. I'm so grateful for those of you that brought me here and contributed to Sherry for all your organizing and for putting me up, to Jan, to Brian, to Becky, to David, for all your hospitality and for all of you. I'm just honored to be here. Con cariño. Lifesaver yesterday. Lifesaver. I held on to this not to be nervous. Because we're all lifesavers. Sometimes we need one.
And I suggest that we all take the hands of people that are near us, and we'll have a couple moments of silence, reflecting on that day and what that meant to us. And then I would like to ask, I'd like to ask people that were here on that morning, on the 1st of September, 1987, to come forward if you'd like to say a few words, up to 2 minutes each.
Oh dear, listen, moments of silence don't really work so well like on an endless bad news and horror show, but we're just going to have to segue to okay, that was 5 years ago. Whammy, during our moment of silence, go 24 hours for a planetary revolution. Well, that on the Mark Copeland Vimeo from 2012. And we're all standing in a circle there at the end, but it's not quite the end yet.
Thank you. It's nice to not hear that horrible whistle of the train approaching, and did 25 years ago.
Oh, it said checkout parts 2, 3, and 4, so I have to go find them. I got the darn Vimeo. Never mind. Goodbye, Vimeo. What was I gonna say? I always go blank on the mic, but it's not a problem because it's all there on BrooklynLiberationRadio.info. Thanks to Aaron Schwartz, who gave us all for the Akashic Link. Now, if you don't have the actual Akashic Link and you want to go back to 24 hours ago, it will be on the upcoming, and I haven't thought of what I'm going to name this show, but it's not a problem because... Now I've got to say something. Okay. Well, this is what's in front of me. Screech, stop, back up. Endless horror and bad news as a fair warning. On June 12th, the government appointed director of the... Hold it, that's not the one I wanted. Talk to people. No, it was... Oh, yes. On March 20th, 2017, police officers were videotaped shooting at the car carrying President Aristide and FANMI, Lavalas presidential candidate Dr. Maurice Maryse Narcisse, Narcisse, as they returned from court. So, the Lavalas presidential candidate and President Aristide were victims of an assassination attempt. The police officers were reportedly observed returning to the National Palace. There was no condemnation of this blatant assassination attempt by the government. Adding a newly organized Haitian army to this mix is a sign the Haitian government is planning on more repression. The Haitian military's purpose was to protect Haitian dictatorships and to attack any challenges by the Haitian people, whether under the Duvalier dictatorships from 57 to 86, or when the military overthrew the democratically elected Aristide government in 91, leading to the killing of over 5,000 people. The military has been a central anti-democratic institution in Haitian society. When then-President Aristide disbanded the narco-trafficking Haitian military in 95, the army was eating up 40% of the national budget in a country with fewer than two doctors per 100,000 people. Now this infamous military is being restored just as the United Nations is said to begin a staged withdrawal of its troops. This is similar to what happened following the U.S. occupation of Haiti from 1915 to 1934. A period in which 20,000 Haitians were killed as the U.S. forces withdrew. They left in place a neo-colonial army with Haitian faces to do their bidding and continue their repression of popular discontent. So that was from the Bay View, but if you go, it says continued on page 5, and there is no such thing in that edition. So this is from HaitiSolidarity.net. 2017/7 Haiti, stop the repression, no impunity, no new army. So because segueing from the Haitian 24 hours, one planetary revolutionary go with their tracks. If you go out there, 5300 Port Chicago Highway, you will see the little party, resistance party anniversary this Friday, September 1st, 30 years after Brian lost his legs. And you just heard him from Mark Copeland's Vimeo. And we all started with Max's Namas No More, which he had played like 10 years ago in 2007. I think it was the 20th anniversary. And he asked her to play it at the next gig. But Brian's out of town, so our birthday party this year will be at the same place. Yeah, 5300 Port Chicago Highway. I doubt the military is going to let us camp out on their side of the no trespassing line, though, because I did block that weapon. And I had been, like, gone since 2009, but I'm back! Oops, where were we? Barcelona? Oh, no.
Related, though, of course. Barcelona! Was it a false flag? All sorts of interesting questions being raised. And this is the story that we talked about last week, but it's updated. I've been throwing in updates. I've got two sources over in Barcelona who are sending me updates, some of it in slightly off-key English, but that's a mark of authenticity, just like scars in fine leather. So anyway, what are some of the questions, Tony? Well, this ID, the brother's mysterious ID card just dropped in the van. Nobody's talking about that in the mainstream, but why do terrorists always drop their ID cards? How about the lack of footage of the actual van attack? This street in Barcelona has got, it's completely covered by cameras, the Rambla Street. It's notorious for pickpockets, prostitution. It's totally blanketed in security cameras. There's a major shortage of actual footage of the attack. That's, you know, these are just questions, and there are a lot more. People want to look at all these questions.
Let's move some of these slides forward as we're going through this.
Okay.
Please.
Yeah, so next slide, we have the Spanish police shooting Yunus Abu Yaqub, one of the supposed attackers. They said that he held up what looked like an explosives belt and shouted Allahu Akbar, so they shot him dead, and he'll never be able to tell any tales, just like the rest of them. As always, they shoot them all dead rather than arrest and interrogate them.
Well, it's not as always. Sometimes it doesn't work that way, but this way it works that way in spades. And you say the word Abu Yaqub. So here's a person with a Arab-sounding name, with an exotic name, and I wanted to stop a little bit on this story in Reuters and read the entry to the article by Angus Berwick. So here's how the news is described by Reuters these days. Spanish police on Monday shot dead an Islamist militant who killed 13 people with a van in Barcelona last week. Well, okay, if he was still alive, it would be alleged. But since he's dead, you can just announce he did it. He killed. There's, you know, who says he did it? What's your evidence he did it? Well, it says it in Reuters. There it is. And this same report says, you know, there was a cell of 11 people who've mostly been killed. And five were shot the day after. And we discussed this last week. So well, who says there's a cell? And anyway, so
the Rothschilds say so, Tony. The Rothschilds.
Yeah, well, that's what Reuters.
Now. Okay, the Moses Bauer connection. We are the 99% because Moses Bauer's Hessian banksters paid us for the scalps of Native children in California. The U.S. was founded to evade slavery. But,
is. So, I mean, the declining, the fake news, like, this has the marks. Why should, you know, there's got to be some evidence for things. But no, according to Reuters and Berwick, you just say these things because the people are dead and can't speak for themselves. And it's
yeah.
fake news, Reuters, you're fake news.
Okay. And, you know, there's so many of these oddities about these events. And again, people can go to my Veterans Today article, which is updated with lots of, you know, new questions as they come up. The and next slide.
Well, that's Kevin Barrett and blah, blah, blah.
They're on the tube as three knife men rampaged on London Bridge. And so she was in that lockdown after that attack. And she was in the Notre Dame Cathedral on the day that a police officer was stabbed outside the cathedral, another huge front page headline attack over in Paris. And here she is right there on La Rambla in Barcelona. I think that's probably coincidence, just bad luck. But, you know, it's odd how some of the same faces keep showing up. And in some cases, it's clearly not coincidence, Tony. For instance, when, you know, the Mossad photographer shows up pre-positioned to take pictures of the truck attack in Nice and then shows up less than a week later taking the first pictures of the attack in Munich at the shopping mall. I mean, you know that that's not a coincidence. This one, however, could be.
Somehow the word synchronicity comes to mind. Maybe there's some divine intervention here.
And here she is right there on La Rambla in Barcelona. I think that's probably coincidence, just bad luck. But, you know, it's odd how some of the same faces keep showing up. And in some cases, it's clearly not coincidence, Tony. For instance, when, you know, the Mossad photographer shows up pre-positioned to take pictures of the truck attack in Nice and then shows up less than a week later taking the first pictures of the attack in Munich at the shopping mall. I mean, you know that that's not a coincidence. This one, however, could be.
Somehow the word synchronicity comes to mind. Maybe there's some divine intervention here.
Right. So maybe Julia Monaco, the 26-year-old Australian woman who keeps showing up at these events, needs to ask Allah, you know, what the meaning of these amazing signs is. In any case, in the next slide, we do have the Muslims demonstrating against terrorism in Barcelona. And of course, Muslims massively loathe the so-called Islamic State. Their popularity is in low single digits, and that's just because the, you know, 2% of the people are mishearing the question. And yet, the mainstream media will never tell you that.
Yeah, and of course, whenever you hear that ISIS is involved and ISIS publicity agent Rita Katz at Site Intelligence is involved in stating that ISIS did it, it's got to be a signal that something's up here. Don't trust such a report.
Absolutely. So let's move on to why ISIS or Daesh or whatever you want to call them is a false flag group. And anytime any ISIS or Daesh event happens, it's by definition a false flag. Let's move on to the occupied Muslim East. Don't say Middle East, say Muslim East. Here we are in Syria, where the U.S. forces are going to be occupying Syria for decades, according to the spokesperson of the SDF, Syrian Democratic Forces. The U.S. is going to be there to make sure that the Kurds are able to break up the neighboring countries in Iraq and Syria in particular, but they would love to go after Iran and probably Turkey as well. So another permanent occupation.
Is there some good literature that you know of describing this incredibly active use of Kurds as sort of frontmen for empire, as justifiers of empire, so they can say, well, it's not really us doing it, we're backing the Kurds, and they have, you know, they're seeking their sovereignty and their indigenous people.
There is the object lesson, remember the Kurds from the Bush 1, telling the Kurds to rise up, and then Of course, all of a sudden, a couple years before, you see the picture of Rumsfeld shaking hands with Saddam, and then, of course, under the watchful gaze of the occupying Americans, the machine gunning by helicopter of the Kurds, in the midst of all of our no-fly BS, which is very selectively used, look how you pull the rug out. Before the underdog that you always side with in the divide and conquer strategy, becomes a real power, you pull the rug out as they happen to be, the pawns of the powers that be, the power junkies that deal with the U.S. are, patently transparent, like Barzani, who disarmed the Yazidis before that genocide.
Who don't have their own nation state. So we're simply helping the Kurds.
Well, I'm sure there's an abundance of such literature in Turkish. I see stuff, articles, but if I come across a book on it, I'll let you know, Tony.
Mm-hmm.
In June, the U.S. forces allowed the ISIS or Daesh fighters to escape from, where was it, in Raqqa. And back a little before that, they escaped Mosul and were given safe passage to Syria by U.S. forces. I mean, these ISIS or Daesh, they are false flag actors working for the empire. So whether or not a terror event is completely staged, it doesn't matter. It's still false flag.
Well, maybe the living out of its usefulness of this ISIS-Daesh proxy army that was very useful, maybe it's being downgraded now or transformed into another incarnation. And maybe that's why Charlottesville, there's so much attention on.
You said that better, Tony. Well, how about this next story? The USS John McCain, how symbolic is that? Hit by cyber hackers, it smashed into a freighter out there in the Straits of Malacca. And there are speculations that there was some kind of cyber attack going on. And whether or not that's true, I thought it was interesting that this picture of the John McCain looks an awful lot like the USS Liberty, the Israeli attack on the American unarmed spy ship in 1967 that was completely covered up to the point of death threats against the family members of the guys who were on that ship by Admiral McCain, the father of the current stricken U.S. senator. So in any case, this story about a possible cyber threat to U.S. ships over there in the Straits of Malacca is pretty interesting because it illustrates the vulnerability of navies. We're in a new world. Admiral Mahan, back in the 19th century, said that whoever rules the waves rules the world. That was true for Britannia then. It's true for the U.S. up until now. But now that there are means of taking out ships, both electronic, as we saw with the Donald Cook, these new generation missiles, the Sunburn missiles and so on, that can go at really ridiculous speeds and do amazing evasive maneuvers, the navies are no longer going to rule the world. And so
Norway mass shooting, it's a bit hard for me to focus on that one because there's so many that has happened recently, and I would humbly suggest all of them connected. What we're seeing, they're all connected. And this is also why I've been able to predict quite a few of them. I think I'm up to 5 or 6 now where I'm on international radio, been able to predict on the exact location, more or less the exact time, and so on. So, but back to the Norway alleged mass shooting. I say alleged because the word alleged will be used many, many times when you look into false flags, because the whole thing with the false flag is that it's the one that is being attacked that is actually the attacker. The attacker is blaming their operation on a patsy, but actually it's them doing it. So the whole false flags scenario is that it's based on an old Roman tactic called problem reaction solution. The few in power secretly create a problem to get a reaction from us. The reaction they want is an emotional outcry or panic so that they can come with their solution. So with the Norway attack, it's a really, really interesting example, I would say. It's the biggest mass murder said to have been carried out by one single person since the Second World War. So I find it very odd that I am one of very, very few that has actually looked into it. We're just a handful of people. I've been on location in more or less all of these different places in Europe where these attacks have said to have been carried out. And I tell you, it is a bizarre world to enter. So I have prepared a slideshow, so I'm going to go to screen share here, and 2 seconds, boom, let's see if it goes better. And hopefully you will see something. Wait, I've done hundreds of interviews, most of them are on YouTube, and I'm covering so many of these different false flags in great detail. So anything you're interested in, please go there. And normally when I talk about this one in Norway, I do like almost a 2-hour presentation. So it's a bit hard to do it in 20 minutes, but I'm gonna just scratch on the surface, but show you that something really weird went down this way, this day. So these are some of the images, these awful images that we were presented that were being pumped out through international media. And you can see here, if this is true, absolutely horrific. You see this woman here, her whole face is covered in blood. There's a woman here with a almost 20 centimeter long wooden stick sticking out of her head, and so on. Lots of people who were injured and so on. This happened on the 22nd of July, 2011, the same date that several other of these attacks have been carried out as well, because they have a very strong tendency to repeat the same date due to numerology and other aspects. Anyway, so let's have a look at it. When a false flag is carried out, one of the sure signs that you can see that it is a false flag is not so much about what happens, but what does not happen. So let's see what did not happen this day. The official story is more or less like at the Oklahoma City bomb, that a lone crazy guy called Anders Behring Breivik had a bad day, thought, I'm going to kill a lot of people. So he parked a van outside the government building and then left the car and blew up the government building before he went out to an island and mass murdered a lot of teenagers. So I'm just going to go step to step through this whole thing. Well, this day, unfortunately, the police alarm PC was turned off, so there was no alarm that went out. And unfortunately, even though it was in the end of July, which is a high season with tourism in Norway, there were only 4 to 5 police officers on duty that day. And unfortunately, 2 of them were guarding the Israeli and US embassies, meaning there were only 3 in charge. And due to different things, when this happened, unfortunately, the police had to go without weapons because they had been asked to give the weapons in a few weeks before, so they were locked into gun boxes, and they could only be given out with special permits, which they didn't have this day. And unfortunately, the mobile network seemed to have been blown up when this whole thing exploded, so they couldn't use that either. And unfortunately, a lot of the communication, because nothing was working this day, had to be done by fax. That was the only thing that was working this day. And unfortunately, the fire brigade, even though it's only like 200-300 yards from where the government building is, due to the explosion, they couldn't get the trucks out because they say that the doors, exit doors from the fire station were blocked due to glass and so on. So that was a bit of a bummer. And the helicopter crews that could have been really essential in this whole operation, since it was there were 2 different operations ongoing on the same day, the helicopter crews had just been given extra holiday for this day, so they were not that day. So a bit of a bad day. And when all of these false flags are carried out, you will see constantly the same type of setup. And one of the main ingredients in this these setups are the drills. There's always a drill that is before this whole thing is carried out. And this drill is there for the people who are behind these operations to get vehicles in position, explosives in position, smoke bombs, crisis actors, you name it, and also be able to rehearse the theme that is then going to go live. And here in Norway, we had both anti-terror drills in Oslo, where they were training a similar event like happened with the government building, and as well on the island, a similar event as on the island. So the guy who parked this car, the van, and then left it, he left it in a police uniform. That police uniform is identical to the Norwegian SWAT team uniform. And I'm going to come back to how I would claim that the Delta, the Norwegian Delta forces, are extremely central in this operation. I would even claim that they are part of carrying it out and then blaming it on a lone patsy, in this case, an individual named Anders Behring Breivik. The reason why they always claim it on a lone crazy guy or a lone fanatic is because if this person is alone, then by law there's no conspiracy. And then it's a lot easier to deal with in a court case. And if he's crazy, then no motive. Or if he's fanatic, Allah Akbar, then, well, it was because he was a fanatic. No reason to look into more of the details. When this whole thing happened with this government building, it was a very, very strange event, because one of the things I noticed right away was that people that was very close to the government building didn't hear any explosion, but people that were 25 kilometers away from the thing, they heard the explosion and also felt the heat wave and so on from the bomb. Not the heat wave, the pressure wave that came from the bomb, but not the people in the center of this whole thing. And also the windows, instead of being blown into the shops in the surrounding area, were sucked out. So on the streets around, in the whole block around the government building, the glass were out in the street, like if the explosion had been on the inside, spread out in the area. I spoke to Chip Tatum about this, and he said if it was a high energy weapon, what they would need to have are sort of like target markers, where they were needed the different devices to mark the area that should be hit and to mark the area that should not be hit.
So we're going to go into Eskil Peterson, the head of the youth party, who grounded the ferry so that rescue was impossible. Now it's a 1-minute ride. Why did it take an hour? Because it's a NATO op. Okay. Oslo is synonymous with the peace for Palestinians that preceded Behring Breivik, that atrocity, no doubt, where the police said, oh, have your parents call. Where was I?
So anyway, after Anders Behring Breivik is said to have blown up the government building, he took a car, another car, he had two cars, and went north, northwest of Oslo, out to a beautiful little heart-shaped island called Utøya, which is a very beautiful little island in the middle of nowhere that has been used for by the Social Democrat, their youth party, as a summer camp. This day, it is said that there was more than 550 teenagers on the island. So he came in a police uniform, and he took the ferry across, and with him, he had a big bag, and in the bag, it said that he had all of these weapons and ammunition and so on. And the people came out and greeted him and said, welcome, why are you here? He didn't really answer. Instead, he just picked up a gun and shot the two first people in the head, one of them being the stepbrother of the Norwegian princess. And then he picked out an automatic rifle and started mass killing teenagers on this island. So these teenagers were just totally panicking and running around everywhere trying to hide, while trying also to call the police. But unfortunately, we're back to the unfortunately thing here again, the police that answered the phone didn't believe the panicking teenagers and said, no, please call your parents and get them to call us, otherwise we will not believe you, so we're not going to send any police cars and so on. And also, hundreds of distress calls never got through because the line to the police headquarters were blocked. And unfortunately, then when the ambulances finally came, they were stopped by police on location. And also when the police finally, after almost an hour, tried to get to the island, somebody blocked the police boat radio channel, so they couldn't be contacted either. And unfortunately, the super modern Tetra digital new system didn't communicate with the old analog system, so that the police and the and everyone else couldn't communicate either. So we're back to the faxes. Also, there was a police helicopter with a sharpshooter, and he said, or they said, we are ready to go. Let's go. We can get take him out immediately, because this guy was allowed to be on this island and killing teenagers for one solid hour. And I timed from the mainland out to the island. If you really want to go there quickly in a rubber boat or whatever, it takes about 1 minute to get there. 1 hour he was let alone out there. But this sharpshooter was told to stand down, do not interfere. Okay. And unfortunately, there were some Bell 740 helicopters from military squadron not so far from there, were with all without fuel. What a bummer. And so a simple person like me would say, well, get the get down to the nearest gas station, get some fuel and get these helicopters off the ground. But no, it was first way after this whole thing ended that they were airborne. And very weirdly also, after he was finally arrested after 1 hour, the shooting continued for 5 to 7 minutes afterwards. Go figure that one. And in the end, when finally the whole thing ended, in total, the pathologist counted to 86 dead. And they went out, it was for 2 days, I believe it was, in media, 86 dead. Then that went down to 69. And then in the end, we ended on 77, which is a very symbolic number as well when it comes to this weird numerology that these forces are using. So I don't know about you, 86, I mean, if you have bodies lying there, that one is not breathing, that one is. That means one dead, that's one. There's another one, two, three, four, five, and so on. If you have 86 ones not breathing, how can that go down to 69? And a super duper Delta team that is highly trained and equipped for a situation like this. So they were there, they came out, they were very delayed and they missed the island. They stopped and asked, where's the island? The people pointed out, it's right over there. So what did they do? They kept going in their car and went some further 3-4 kilometers north before they put in the rubber boat. But then there were 11 people with a lot of heavy equipment in it, in this Delta team. I mean, this is a super duper SWAT team. So this is what happened. This is not Monty Python. This is 11 Delta team, highly super duper trained police officers on the way to the island. Unfortunately, there were too many in the boat, so it started to take in water and that killed the engine. So they were drifting around until a normal person, a civilian, came and said, what's going on? And so they took his boat and left him in the rubber boat, and then 11 Delta team members went in the boat that could hardly move either because there were so many. But then finally they got going there, and after 1 hour they arrived to the island. Here's the island, Utøya, and I found that very short, close by, there's actually what is called Sentralanlegget, which is the war center of Norway. It's an underground army base, a super duper high technology. So, away, this is like 3 miles, not even that. Okay, this is where the Delta team, they came here, and instead of putting the rubber boat here, going straight across, being there within a minute or so, they decided to go all the way up here and put the rubber boat in there. And then they got in here, they took, they got the wrong island to start with, and then finally they went down here and slowly, with the help of that other boat, they got to the island in two different groups. But also, there was a ferry that was, it was actually an old military vessel that armored vessel. And the person on the island that escaped as soon as the shooting started was the, the head of the youth party, Eskil Pedersen. He and eight other people jumped into this ferry, and instead of going and trying to help the youngsters, teenagers was trying to escape from the island, swimming in the water while being shot at, many of them killed in the water. But instead of using this armored ferry that could have saved many, many lives, they went all the way, they went all the way up there in the green circle, where they rammed the boat up on shore so that it couldn't be used, leaving the rest to die.